Welcome to Artworks, the weekly podcast from the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Josephine Reed. Wayne Valier is an Ojibwe birch bark canoe maker. He's a language advocate, and he's somebody who is one of the great educators and protectors of cultural practice in his community of Lac des Flambeaux in Wisconsin. He is also a 2020 National Heritage Fellow. His work in revigorating the tradition of birch bark canoe making is in some ways an archetypal form of folk and traditional arts. That is, it's an art form that's made for, by, and about the community that uses it. The Ojibwe is a nation and cultural community that has deep connection to the waterways. And the birch bark canoe was used for transportation, fishing, harvesting wild rice, and hunting. The tradition of building these canoes had been handed down for millennia, and it requires carpentry, weaving, the ability to read a forest, and engineering. It's a boat as beautiful as it is functional. It is, in fact, one of the most sophisticated inland watercrafts in the world. And Wayne Valier is one of only a handful of native birch bark canoe builders today in the United States. And Wayne has made it his mission to preserve his culture, particularly birch bark canoe building, as a living tradition for future generations. I spoke with Wayne recently with a less than wonderful internet connection, so I alert you there is a transcript to this podcast. Still, it was a great conversation, and I began by asking him if he was raised in the traditions of the Anishinaabe.
Yes, I was. You know, from my earliest memory, traditional ways were spoken of and practiced in our family. My parents, they kept company with elders themselves. So I was exposed to elders at a very early age and learning from elders and the importance of native knowledge that the elders hold.
Was that unusual at that time when you were growing up? Was your family unusual for keeping to traditional ways, or was that more common?
And it was unusual because in the early 70s in our community, there were very old people that still had our old knowledge, but there were very few younger people picking it up. Boarding schools, different things, and historical traumas, there was a pause, I guess. So what happened was there wasn't a lot of culture around at the time. There was just a few elders that had that kind of knowledge.
I'm curious how you came to recognize the centrality of reclaiming that culture, not as a dead tradition, but as a way of living.
I truly believe that we as human beings, we all have a destiny. And my destiny from the day I was born was to be involved in culture. My grandmother predicted when I was born with a white streak in my hair. My grandmother told my mother that she believed I was a reincarnated elder at the time I was born. And she said someday that this grandchild of mine will be a cultural bearer. And as I grew up, my mother was very, very surprised at how I was drawn to culture since my earliest memory and throughout my life, and in the importance of saving our different cultural areas before they slipped into the pages of history so they could remain alive.
Now, you learned to make a vast array of different native arts and artifacts, moccasins, needlepoints, etc. But you came to it, if I understand this correctly, through your painting. You were painting these things and then wondered how to make them.
Yes, being exposed and seeing these things, but also doing research of the daily life of the Anishinaabe, to, I guess, museum pieces and different writings and different photographs and researching the tools and the weapons and the clothing they wore at the time. And I think I was 16 when I realized that I really wanted to learn how to make the things that I was painting. And it started a remarkable journey of knowledge for me. And it was one thing led to the next. And pretty soon, you know, I have enough knowledge to pretty much build everything in those paintings I used to make.
Is that when you learned to speak Ojibwe, or had you known the language previously?
Ojibwe, Anishinaabe Mon, Ojibwe Mon, it was spoken by our grandmother fluently, and she spoke it to us a lot. And the elders, my parents, also spoke a lot of Ojibwe Mon. So we were raised hearing the language a lot. And then I guess when I was 16, I started to make a decision that I was going to move to fluency in my language. And I quickly realized that the language, our sound is the nucleus of our culture. Because without our language, we can't convey our prayers to the Great Spirit and its helpers. And we can't thank what we call Manidu spirits for the gifts that we get in the woods. So the language is the nucleus of our culture. Our language has our worldview, which is totally different than American worldview. It's a very respectful language. There's no swear words in our language. It's always positive, respectful manner people are spoken to and addressed.
Birch bark canoe making was almost a lost art. And I'd like you to explain the importance of the birch bark canoe to the Anishinaabe.
I guess the importance of the birch bark canoe for our people is everywhere we traveled, we're a hunter-gathering tribe, the Ojibwe people. And we hunt and gather our foods in nature. And this brings us to different seasonal camps where we have to travel to. And in northern Wisconsin, you can't throw a rock without hitting a lake. So it was much easier to paddle across a lake and portage a light 60, 68 pound canoe over a mile to the next lake and paddle 9 miles across. So the birch bark canoe was used for that. But it was also used as a shelter when they were traveling. It was used for, like I said, all of the industrial year of the Anishinaabe. It took them to the rice beds and also harvesting wild rice from the birch bark canoe. They hunted from a canoe using a torch, casting artificial light into the woods where Wawa Skeshi, the deer, the ones whose eyes glow, would shine. They would hunt a deer that way by seeing their eyes with a torch, and also fish in the lakes. The eyes of the walleye glows at night from our torches, and we spear fish through a birch bark canoe. So all of these things, from the child to the elder, birch bark canoes played a big role in the life of the Anishinaabe. And I believe that it's a great part of our identity at a time when birch bark canoe building was common knowledge amongst all Anishinaabe. Because every family needed a birch bark canoe. So the knowledge was common going down to 5 master Ojibwe canoe builders in the Midwest. It became a very scary thought, becomes a very scary thought for me. So in my life, I've actually produced 1 canoe builder, and I'm working on the 2nd right now. We're changing that in my generation. We're making sure that some young people will have this skill enough to keep it alive to teach the greater public.
They are as beautiful as they are functional. And obviously it is a time-consuming art, as most art is. And you've said you have to make it on nature's time, not your time. I want you to say more about that and talk about the steps that go into making these canoes.
Yes, we are on nature time when we do work with most natural materials when we're doing different things. But the birch bark canoe, it brings us to all the seasons. For example, the bark, the birch bark that comes off the tree, comes off in the spring in June of the year. That's the only time you can really get it off in huge sheets where it's easy and the best time. It can also be harvested in the fall. It's called winter bark. There again, we go to the fall, another season, to harvest another bark. The cedar is harvested in the winter here because we go into the swamps. The cedar swamps are quite impassable any other season. So we go in the winter when the swamp is frozen, the swamp floor is frozen. So we can harvest the cedar and skid that out and process that. The roots are gotten in the summertime, when the ground is soft and processed. The pitch, the sealant for the canoe, is harvested in the fall when the pines, the evergreens, express all their sap from the previous summer. So all of these different materials are harvested at different times and they're processed down. And it's usually in the spring of the year when the bark comes off the tree is the time Anishinaabe would begin his canoe building. So that's kind of on nature's clock. And when that season comes, you have to be there. And I tell my apprentices that we're on nature's time and nature isn't on our time. Grandmother Earth, we're on her time.
Wayne, you don't make these canoes in isolation. You have students, you have apprentices, you've mentored over 100 students, and you're determined that this tradition is carried on as a living tradition. And I want you to talk about having these canoes, not as a piece of art to be hung on a wall, but you make them to be used. These canoes are something that's alive and vibrant and vital to the Anishinaabe culture.
Yes, at our public school, we do a canoe launch and we display it where all our students can see it. But we also use the canoe at different times of the year to demonstrate different cultural areas for our students. But me personally, I have my personal birch bark canoe where I could be seen all the time using it. And also we went to several other communities throughout the Midwest and had projects where we built canoes in different communities, planting the seed of birch bark canoe building. So those people are coming back to us and they're doing it. So we're pretty happy about that.
You don't just teach them how to build a birch bark canoe. You developed a program called These Canoes Carry Culture, which I think is really terrific. And I'd like you to say more about the program and the culture that the canoes carry.
Well, you know, These Canoes Carry Culture, the industrial year of the Anishinaabe, all of the different harvesting we do throughout the four seasons is in that canoe. During that time, there's storytelling, there's teachings that are happening. Life happens around when we're building canoes. Camaraderie happens amongst strangers that are building canoes. Friendships happen. So it's really magical. It's kind of a teaching, all these different materials that come from different parts of the environment that come to make a beautiful watercraft. When people come together like that, they become one. And there becomes harmony amongst canoe building because it's really hard work. And it's also very gratifying. Each stitch, the smells and all of it, the sounds, it's very sacred to the Anishinaabe. And people that are involved with this building process, they see the spiritual part of it because all the materials that we harvested, we have ceremonies for. The material is asked permission to take it. And it's begged a thousand pardons when we do take it. But also in these canoes that we teach, also we have a message of conservation and environment and making sure that we have birch forests for Ge'ongdadazijig, for the ones that are not yet born, making sure that we have good pine trees that are going to produce the pitch that we need, and also the cedar forest so that they're healthy. And our grandchildren will be able to go and harvest those things as they need them. So those messages are also passed on to our people and to my students about the importance of conservation and awareness of these environments and speaking out to the world the importance of the environments about clean water and clean air and all these things that are very important to the Anishinaabe people because it's our way of life. It affects our way of life every day.
I'm curious about teaching and culture. First, if and then how you see a difference between teaching and learning in Western culture as opposed to teaching and learning in Anishinaabe culture.
I see teaching and learning quite different. I actually teach a method I call teaching culturally, which is I don't teach culture, I teach culturally, meaning that, for example, a pair of moccasins, for example, moccasins are made out of deer skin and quills and different things that we made traditionally. But showing a student a pair of moccasins opposed to going farther back and explaining about the deer herd, where the deer come from, what the deer do, how we harvest the deer, bringing the deer in and actually tanning the deer skin, showing all that work, showing patterning, talking about patterning, actually making the moccasins and how the pucker toe moccasins signifies our tribe and what those stitches mean. And finally, when you put that moccasin on, you're walking in the steps of your ancestors. So that's teaching culturally. And we do that in a, with a lot of different things while we're teaching. It's always been three-dimensional for our students. So we try to make our teaching three-dimensional the same way. We bring in Western techniques as well and show the parallel with Anishinaabe techniques. That way our children tend to take better ownership of it. And it's a known fact that students do better when they see themselves in school. So we make sure of that in our public school. And we have an administration that's, they're really good people and they're totally behind our endeavor.
You were artist in residence at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, where you built a birch bark canoe. And you brought in children from the public school at Lac du Flambeau. And I really want you to tell me about this project and how it served as a learning for everyone involved.
Oh, yeah. It's the residency at UW-Madison. It was really awesome. We built it in the wood shop. It was right in the building where they had all the artists. I think it's called the Humanities Building. What was really cool about it was there were so many different cultures that came and visited the canoe. And pretty soon, these different cultures started getting involved in this canoe building. We had people studying the Sami culture to, you know, the Scandinavians to Koreans to Chinese people to Latino people that were involved. We had a day when we were standing around the canoes and we were singing all these different cultural songs and all these different languages. So it was really cool. And it was also an awesome opportunity to bring our students from the Lac du Flambeau Public School down to a Big Ten university and see Native culture being showcased at a Big Ten university. And since that time, we've actually had two students that have enrolled in UW-Madison from our public school that were exposed to the school because of that residency. So it was really cool. It was a lot of really good things that happened at the university.
You've said to your students that they don't have to lose their identity to become educated in the Western world. And I'm wondering if that's still the fear, that you do have to lose your identity to get that education, because in the past, historically, that in fact had been true.
What happens is it's because of historical trauma, things that have happened that in the past and our grandfather's time that has brought us forward to the way people feel about certain things today. We're still affected today by it. So we show like our traditional teachings, we have values and teachings. And what we're showing is how to use these values in modern times and modern problems and modern things. So we can live as spiritual people and believe our way, our creation stories. We can believe all of our medicines, all of our different things we do that makes us Anishinaabe. We can still have all those things, but also we have the ability to learn Western culture also and Western education. And we can have the best of both worlds.
Sustainability, as you mentioned, is so central to your work. And slowly, slowly, we in the West understand more and more the damage we're doing to the environment. Do you find people are paying more attention to the way of life that you're practicing?
Yeah, I think they are. I think especially my apprentices, you know, my apprentice, his name is Lawrence Mann. He's been with me for 6 years. It's been amazing to watch the transformation of this young man and the knowledge that he carries and how he carries it and how he passes it back down to the next generation already. And it gives me hope that it is possible and it is happening because we're seeing it.
When you were young, your grandmother challenged you about the way you want to be remembered. Can you recall for us what that challenge was?
My grandfathers are written throughout history by non-Native history writers in the past, going back as far as 150 years. But not only that, but in the stories of our people and our oral stories that go way back, all the way back to Madeline Island, which is the 1500s. From our mother, we could retrace our grandfather all the way back to Madeline Island in the 1500s. He was the chief of all the Ojibwe of the Midwest at one time, off Madeline Island and all the Wisconsin Ojibwe. His sons in the lineage of chieftainship that came down through our first grandfather that landed on Madeline Island, they were great men and they did great things for the people. And she challenged us as she talked to us and told us stories about these men. She said, now look at all of the stuff that's said about your grandfathers, the ones that came before you. And what I challenge you guys, you young boys, is what are your grandchildren going to say about you? What are the stories that are going to be written about you? What things are you going to do?
And finally, when you've received so many awards, it's really extraordinary. And now you've been named a National Heritage Fellow. And I wonder what this award means for you.
Well, it's very humbling. It's very humbling. But also, I accept this award on behalf of the Anishinaabe, the Ojibwe Nation, because ultimately the knowledge that I carry is not mine. It belongs to the Anishinaabe Nation. And I thank all of my teachers and people that have taken their time to show me these things. And also the promises I made to pass it down, how important it was to them not to hold on to it, to make sure I pass it down so it stays alive. That's it.
Your work is so beautiful. Aside from its cultural importance, it is utterly gorgeous. And congratulations, and thank you for giving me your time.
Thank you.
That's Birch Bark Canoe Builder, teacher, culture bearer, and 2020 NEA Heritage Fellow, Wayne Valier. Celebrate the 2020 National Heritage Fellows in an online broadcast on March 4th, 2021 at 8 p.m. Eastern Time at arts.gov. Trust me, you'll really want to see Wayne at work, so mark that calendar for March 4th. You've been listening to Artworks, produced at the National Endowment for the Arts. Subscribe to Artworks and leave us a rating on Apple. It helps people to find us. For the National Endowment for the Arts, I'm Josephine Reed. Stay safe, and thanks for listening.